Good afternoon, you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please.
May I please the court, counsel? For the record, my name is Jan Van Amerongen. I represent Robert Garvey below with Jennifer Kate Aronson, who is seated at counsel table with me, and together we represent him on this appeal. Your Honor, with the court's permission, I would reserve 4 minutes to address remarks after opposing counsel has had an opportunity. If I could begin, Your Honor, with what is the first argument on the appeal, which deals with a suppression issue. Procedurally, Your Honor, there was at one point a different set of defense attorneys and a different set of prosecutors as this case took some time. And it was Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Nutter of the Public Defender's Office who filed the appeal and argued it. The suppression motion, and it was decided by Judge Goldstein. Your Honor, the issue, quite simply, is whether or not there was a waiver, whether or not Detective Brock and Detective Spell, who were conducting the interrogation, should have proceeded as they did with the interrogation, or should have attempted to clarify the remarks made by Mr. Garvey. The Miranda warnings, I'll call them, were read to Mr. Garvey. He was asked by the detectives, and I'll just read it, Your Honor. He was asked, understanding those rights, are you willing to give a statement if I ask you certain questions? And his response was, depends on what you ask me. Your Honors, it seems that in a nutshell, depends on what you ask me is either considered analogous to, I understand my rights, I acknowledge my rights, and I will pick and choose, as you question me, whether or not I will exercise a right on a question-by-question basis. That appears to be the argument of the state.
Well, isn't that what Judge Goldstein wrote in his opinion?
It is, Your Honor.
What effect does that have on the way in which we review it?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to your review, in that there was no testimony of a live witness, there was no credibility determinations made of a live witness, and those types of determinations which some reviewing court would typically give due deference to the trial court's ability to observe those factors. Your Honor, I believe it's a de novo review with respect to these issues. It's a de novo review with respect to what objectively depends on what you ask me means.
But let me make sure I understand that. Obviously, Judge Goldstein didn't hear your client when he said those words. He's simply looking on a piece of paper at what was said or listening to what the police officer testified and said. Is that what you mean by that?
Well, Your Honor, actually what he did was he, the only evidence admitted was the videotape. So he observed the videotape. I don't believe there was yet a transcript prepared of what was said at that point. I believe the transcripts were all prepared much closer to trial.
Well, given multiple interpretations on what those words meant and a finding by the trial judge, you still believe it's de novo for us?
Yes, Your Honor. And in light of the fact that there were multiple interpretations, I would also argue that that it was ambiguous, Your Honor, but that the more likely interpretation is that he wasn't sure yet whether or not he wanted to waive those rights.
Well,
he immediately...
Although the witness wasn't there to testify live, the videotape is about the next best thing that one can ever get to record what actually happened at the time. And isn't it the case that, in Judge Goldstein's opinion, that he not only determined that there had been no waiver and that what the defendant was saying is that, you know, he will answer the questions, but he'll pick and choose what he answers, but that he did that without any hesitation. That is, isn't there a demeanor determination as well as a legal interpretation of what the defendant said?
Saying that a response was given without a pause, which is, I believe, what Judge Goldstein put in his opinion, is different than if it had been a transcript. Perhaps somebody reviewing a transcript would not have known there was a pause or no pause unless the court reporter or somebody put that in there.
Help us understand where you're dealing with the Crawford argument. And let's suppose, totally hypothetically, that the policeman had said, "What do you mean by that?" And the defendant had said, "I mean, you ask the questions, and I'll tell you, I'll decide which ones I'm going to answer and which ones I won't answer. That's it." Would that constitute a waiver?
Your Honor, I believe that it would. I believe at that point it would be objectively clear that he understood his rights and he knew he didn't have to answer each question, which is in essence what the questions and the rights are designed to elicit from someone. But the follow-up question was not asked. Instead, instead what happened is Mr. Garvey said, "What am I charged with? You know, what happened? What are you going to ask me?" Which I think is why it's more reasonable that what he was saying, like when he says, "Depends on what you ask me," is, "I don't know yet why I'm here or what these rights really involve or what they are with respect to." He says, "Why am I here? What am I charged with?" When he's told, in essence, that they have a case against him and that someone died, he says, "Somebody died." And then there never is, he's never taken back by the detectives to the issue of a waiver. They just begin to say, "Those that clam up are going to face the death penalty," and then they start hitting him with questions, and he answers. So, Your Honor, with respect to your question, I think that is a distinct hypothetical than what we've got here, but I do think that that would have been a situation where there would be a waiver.
And what's your response today to the state's argument that, and the state's alternative argument, that it would be a harmless error to the extent it was error because nothing he said was really incriminating?
Well, Your Honor, I think my response has to be in two facets. One, it plays into our second argument about what happened during the playing of the testimony and during during the testimony of Detective Brock. But also, even though he did not, it's our contention, he never admitted doing anything that was amounting to wrongdoing. He never confessed to committing these crimes and never confessed to taking part in planning the crimes. The fact is that he put himself at the scene. The fact is that he put himself in the company of co-defendants at the scene. And those are inculpatory remarks by him. So although explicitly he did not confess to committing the crime, there certainly were facts which I assume were the ones that made the prosecutors at the trial level believe it was relevant evidence and offer it. With respect to the second argument, which that flows right into, Detective Brock, after laying a foundation for what was a redacted statement, at that point it had been redacted, the prosecutors played the tape for the jury and provided them a copy of a redacted transcript that went along with that statement. Detective Brock was then asked by defense counsel on cross-examination, "Detective, when you interviewed Mr. Garvey, Mr. Garvey denied being aware of the robbery plans. Is that fair to say?" And his response was no. At that point, the statement, nowhere in the statement, had Mr. Garvey said, "I took part in the planning, I took part in the commission, I suggested it," or anything like that. He had denied all along when confronted with what had happened. So what has just happened is that Detective Brock, the chief investigating officer in this case, the experienced officer who has also heard the instructions to the jury about what a redacted statement is and isn't, has now told this jury and has stated that Mr. Garvey was aware of the robbery plans. This is then compounded when the next question is, "Would you point to in the transcript where it is that Mr. Garvey admitted to being aware of the robbery plan?" His response is, "The transcript is a redacted version, so," and at that point the court cut him off and we all approached sidebar. And obviously the reason we all approached sidebar was because he has now made reference to an unredacted portion of the
right. Because of the state's response to that,
is it clear that at that point the jury has heard everything you've now stated?
Yes. Those questions were in front of the jury, and that was the last testimony the jury heard that day. The jury was taken out. We had a brief voir dire. It was after 4 o'clock in the afternoon at that point. We reset for the day. So the last thing the jury had heard before breaking overnight was that our client had admitted the knowledge of the robbery plans, and that that admission was in some document or in some tape that they hadn't had a chance to see and that they didn't get to see. The next morning, voir dire commenced or continued with Detective Brock. It became clear from the questioning of Detective Brock that he was basing his answer, according to Detective Brock, on his interpretation of the entire investigation. He was saying that, in his opinion, Robert Garvey had admitted knowledge of the plans because at one point during his interrogation, he had said, maybe they were bringing me there to make me a victim. He said that in light of the co-defendant's statements, which he was privy to and in fact had taken part in the interrogations of some of them, that he didn't believe what Mr. Garvey said, and therefore it was his opinion that Mr. Garvey had in fact knowledge of these plans.
Now that wasn't before the jury.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And then Judge Cooch determined that, Judge Cooch initially had indicated that the question was broad, that the question asked by defense counsel was broad, too broad. But at that point, Judge Cooch had not heard or had ever seen the complete unredacted statement. So based upon only what he had heard, those same two questions the jury heard, he may have thought that there was more of an admission and that had been redacted. However, Your Honor, the next day, Judge Cooch instructed the jury that they were to disregard any reference to any statements made other than what was in this tape. And that was, and he also instructed Detective Brock to limit his answers to questions by either the defense or the state to what's in the tape, hoping that that would clear up the issue and resolve it at that point.
Why didn't it? That is, why did that curative instruction not render any error harmless?
Well, for two reasons, Your Honor. Excuse me. The first is that in this case, unlike in the Steckel case, which was referred to by the state in their brief, this was not an immediate cure. The entire night had gone by in which they were left with the opinion or left with the testimony that a confession or an admission had been made by our client that had been kept from them for some reason. The second reason is that the testimony of Detective Brock was simply not true with respect to whether or not there had been admission. That untruth was allowed to stand and was not addressed by that curative instruction. Judge Cooch determined, at least in the transcript, he stated that he couldn't say that it was completely unresponsive in light of Detective Brock's explanation the next day. Your Honor, credit to the state for what I would call, I shouldn't say credit to the state, but it's almost analogous to damning by faint praise. The way that the state in its brief referred to Detective Brock's responses, not patently unreasonable and not completely baseless, debatable. Those terms were used as a way, I think, of softening what Detective Brock did. On page 22 of the appellee's answering brief, the state discusses how the question was broad in scope, but then states, defense counsel did not ask Brock if Garvey was aware of the plans to rob Donald Jordan and Turquoise Williams. And since Garvey had stated in his police interview that he thought he was the intended victim of the robbery, Brock's negative response is not unreasonable considering the entire context of the situation. What the state is in essence saying there is that if a more narrowly tailored question had been put by defense counsel to Detective Brock, for example, was Garvey aware of plans to rob Donald Jordan and Turquoise Williams, a different answer would have been received by Detective Brock. But what is it, page, I believe it's B105 of the appendix, the state's answering brief. As soon as the detective has retaken the stand, the curative instruction has been given. Ms. Aronson says, you saw the videotape of Mr. Garvey's statement yesterday in this courtroom, correct? Yes. The very next question, Robert Garvey did not state that he was aware of the plan to rob Turquoise Williams and Passion or Donald Jordan, is that correct? That's the very question that the state was suggesting should have been asked in the first place, and the answer was not in those exact words. This is Detective Brock, an experienced police officer, chief investigating officer, who has sat in that courtroom next to the jury the entire trial, and here he is not responding again to what is the truth about that interrogation. And the burden that was then put on defense counsel is, do we ask him questions to clear this up? And the only way to clear it up is to get him to admit that no, our client never explicitly said he did it, but that I believe he, you know, and then have the police officer say, but I believe he did it, which clearly would be prejudicial. So, Your Honor, I believe that Detective Brock was attempting to get over on the defense, and I believe that it was incumbent upon the prosecutors to clear that up, and neither did.
Would it matter to your position whether Detective Brock said whatever he said in a good faith but wrong view of what had happened as opposed to deliberately trying to mislead?
Not in terms of the prejudice caused to our client, because what the jury heard, and there was no way to unring that bell, Your Honor. I saw that the time I had reserved is already up. I have one argument left. If Your Honors, I'll continue on and sacrifice my reserve time.
That's up to you.
Very briefly then, with respect to the third argument, that there were inconsistent results in the jury's findings with respect to felony murder and pecuniary gain. The state indicates first that we have misconstrued the law and Ferguson with respect to that issue. We recognize that pecuniary gain and the definition of robbery or theft are not synonymous. However, they can be, and in this case, because the only motive ever put by the state for this crime and the only motive suggested by the evidence was pecuniary gain, the fact that jurors were unable to conclude unanimously as to pecuniary gain and yet somehow were able to be unanimous with respect to the fact that the killing was committed during the furtherance of a robbery should not be allowed to stand.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court, I'll address the arguments in the order that they were presented today and the order they're presented in the brief. The first argument is the state's position that the pretrial evidence suppression motion was properly denied here, that Judge Goldstein had the opportunity to view the videotape and to see not only what was being said, but the accused's demeanor, the inflection of his voice, and he makes some comments on that in his factual determinations. He says that the accused answered in a clear voice that it depends on what you ask me as to how I'll respond. I think that is not an equivocal statement. It's simply an indication that Mr. Garvey is going to pick and choose as he sees fit what questions he'll ask during the police interrogation.
But that's not the only inference or interpretation that could be made of that response, isn't that true?
Well, I don't know that it's the only one, but I think it's probably the most logical one, given what occurs after that. I mean, Mr. Garvey goes ahead and answers questions, so.
Let's assume that's right. That is, that if we were weighing probabilities, that it was more probable that he intended a waiver. The argument that's being made to us is that without a follow-up question by the interrogating detective, there's no way to know that for sure, and any ambiguity in these in that regard has got to be resolved in favor of the defendant.
Well, I think you have to look at this is a factual determination, I think, although it would certainly involve some semantic interpretation, but the standard of review for factual determinations is clearly erroneous. I don't think this court can say on review that the trial judge who's had the opportunity to actually view the videotape, that his determination is clearly erroneous in this particular instance.
If it were purely a factual determination, that might be so, but the argument that is being advanced to us, as I understand it, is that as a legal matter, in these circumstances, there was an obligation, in effect, to ask the follow-up question.
Well, that's the argument, but I think the way Judge Goldstein handled it was appropriate. He looked at this court's decision in Draper and made a distinction that Draper, the individual, was saying that he was not going to ask questions until he had an opportunity to speak to his mother. That's not what Mr. Garvey said. He just said, well, I'll decide what I'm going to answer. And I think
unless he meant that if you ask me anything about this crime, I'm not answering your questions. If you want to ask me general questions about who am I, what is my business abroad, what brought me to the location you found me on a particular day, I'll answer those questions. Why wouldn't we want to institute as a matter of policy under the Delaware Constitution a requirement that in the case that any reasonable person could consider the response ambiguous, there's an obligation upon the police to ask a follow-up question? Not the better of the two or the most likely of the two interpretations, but any reasonable person could find an ambiguity. What is the harm of requiring the police to ask a simple clarifying question?
Well, I think the harm may be that it may not be just a simple clarifying question, that it may lead to a whole series of questions, and you're getting involved in semantic interpretations and things like that. I think the standard that we have now is appropriate, that unless it's equivocal, the police don't have to clarify the intent, that they can proceed along. It's only if the...
Now, I know that's the rule, but it seems to me that having the trial judge determine to what degree it's equivocal and to what degree it isn't may not be the best policy. The best policy might be to say, if in the mind of any reasonable person this language appears to be equivocal, then you must ask a clarifying question. In order to protect the right against self-incrimination and to protect the right to counsel,
well,
in a custodial situation.
I think the problem is going to be that may be going too far, but, you know, that can certainly be the standard if the court thinks it's appropriate.
And what's surprising after Crawford and after Draper is when you get a response like this, you would think the police would say, what do you mean? And you would think in the normal course of interrogating people, the police would continue to ask questions until they get a yes. What's difficult about the precedent we may establish here is we're talking about nuances that go the other way. How many ways can you say, yes, I waive my rights, without saying, yes, I waive my rights? And your argument seems to be here that when someone says it depends on what you ask, that is an unequivocal waiver. There's nothing ambiguous about that.
Well, I think that's an appropriate finding by the trial court, and I think the trial judge is correct. I mean, maybe the simple way to handle this is if we're going to insist upon follow-up questions, the follow-up question is, okay, you have to tell me and you have to answer yes or no. You know, do you waive your rights, understanding the rights I've read to you? Yes or no, that's the only answer. And if the court wants to promulgate that as a rule, that's fine. I mean, we've had Crawford, but as this court's seen since Crawford, we've had Draper, and we've had, I think it was Pritchett, where the argument was that the defendant waited 10 seconds or 8 seconds or something before responding, and that was enough to constitute an equivocation. So I think, you know, you're making all kinds of judgments. You're making judgments about semantics. You're making judgments about lapse of time. You know, do we really want to get into slicing the cheese that thin? And I think the standard that we have now is sufficient. I think it protects the rights of the accused, and it gives sufficient guidance to the police as to what they're supposed to do.
And going back to Justice Jacobs' question, one way, the way you want us to read what is said is that the answer really means I waive my rights depending on what questions you ask me. But an alternative seems to be, depending on what questions you ask, I'll decide whether I'm going to waive my rights.
Well, that may be, and then I think we just have to look at the thing in context. What happened after Mr. Garvey said that? You know, did he go ahead and respond to questions? And yes, in fact, he did. The redacted videotape's approximately 25 minutes. This is something that occurs early on at the beginning here. So I think, you know, he's fully prepared to answer questions. He's going to decide what questions he's going to answer, but he answers questions.
But that's after he's told, isn't it, that the people that don't answer the questions are getting a death penalty, and the people that do may not?
Well, he certainly has told
that. That seems reasonably persuasive in a custodial situation to an arrestee, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, he knows he's in trouble. I mean, he's been arrested by the police. He has not only his gun.
Do you think that follow-up, rather than a clarification of what he really meant by his comment, would have a more chilling effect on whether he's going to waive his rights or not?
Oh, I think it certainly has a more chilling effect.
Should we not be worried that the police officer heard those words and said, okay, that's good enough, I'm going to go ahead and get into the meat of this thing. I definitely don't want to ask any further question that might allow him to elaborate on whether he wants to exercise his constitutional rights to remain silent or to have a counsel present. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of certainly concern, but it's a question also of reasonable interpretation of what's said here. And the trial judge did have the benefit of actually seeing a videotape. I mean, this isn't an audio tape. He's actually able to see the accused, to assess the entire situation. And the trial judge concluded that under those circumstances, this was a meaningful waiver. You know, it's limited or circumscribed by Mr. Garvey's own placing of parameters on what he's going to say, but the determination is whether or not he's made a meaningful, intelligent, voluntary waiver, and if he has, then interrogation can proceed.
Let's address your other argument, which is that even if there was an error, it was harmless. The response to your argument is that even though in the transcript of the interrogation, Mr. Garvey gave his version of what happened, which was exculpatory, not inculpatory. Nonetheless, there was prejudice here because the statement did place him at the scene at the time the victim was shot.
Well, I think that's true. It places him at the scene, but so did the testimony of the other four witnesses that were involved in this particular robbery scheme. They also placed him there, so it was cumulative evidence at that point. It is an admission from him that he's at the scene, but it's also an explanation. And there's, you know, an upside to this from the defense point of view here. It gives Mr. Garvey an opportunity to place, you know, his version before the jury without having to take the stand and be subject to cross-examination. I think he elected not to testify in this particular trial. So, you know, there was something to be gained from the defense side, too. And
well, what was there? Why would the state attempt to put this statement in if it didn't have some benefit to the state?
Well, I think it has some benefit, but as I say, I think it's cumulative, too. I mean, this is at the very end of the state's case. This is the last witness, and they're putting in the tape. Detective Brock is being recalled for purposes of admitting the videotape. But the jury's already heard all of these other witnesses place him at the scene. So, you know, in that sense, it's cumulative. But, you know, the fact that it's cumulative doesn't necessarily mean it's inadmissible. I mean, the judge can make a discretionary ruling if something's needlessly cumulative and excluded under 403 if the judge thinks that's appropriate. But normally, if it's a statement of the defendant, that's a big deal, and that's going to come in even though aspects of it may be cumulative. Addressing
that, how do you respond to the argument that the detective, instead of saying he never said anything and that was incriminating, characterized the tape as redacted, and then the next day when he was asked the question directly, said, well, not in so many words. It appears that you have an experienced police officer who is not going to give the defense any ground, and at the same time is going to create an inference that there may be something there that he can't talk about. And so my question really is, how does a trial judge deal with that situation? If you're going to have a redacted statement and you don't want to have a negative inference, you know, from the redacted statement. We've had other cases where we tell the parties you have to instruct your witnesses so that we don't start dealing with a problem that we think we've excluded.
Well, I think it's a problem that this court's had before, and it's in this case, it's not something being elicited by the state. It's something that comes out on cross-examination. I guess the question is, you know, did the state have some affirmative obligation to make sure the detective wasn't going to blurt all this out? But I think looking at this brief colloquy that's already been quoted, it's at B96 of the state's appendix here, I think you have to look at it in context, too. Admittedly, what he says is incorrect. He's probably confused about some of it, but it's incorrect. But the context is the jury has already heard the videotape. It's been played. And now Detective Brock is being cross-examined. And the question is, Detective, when you interviewed Mr. Garvey denied being aware of the robbery plans. Is that fair to say? And he says no. But I think a reasonable person responding to that would think, well, okay, the jury's already seen the videotape, so they know what's on the videotape. And if he doesn't say it on the videotape, this must be a question referring to something else. Otherwise, why are you asking what's on the videotape? The jury's already seen the videotape. So I think that may have been the first step down the slippery slope here. And then things kind of get more confused as it goes along. He can't find it in the transcript. I think it's 4:40 p.m. or something at that point. The jury's been excused. The judge says, well, okay, it's a 20-page transcript, the redacted transcript is. I'll give you overnight to try to find this. We'll clear it up in the morning. And defense counsel's been given an opportunity to voir dire Detective Brock that afternoon, and that continues on the next morning. And finally, I guess the judge just concludes that, well, you know, this is... got very confused. It's probably incorrect what the police officer has said if it's taken point blank. And what I'm going to do to try to clear up this whole mess that's now landed in my lap at the end of the state's case here is I'm going to give the curative instruction. I'm going to instruct the jury to disregard his statement. Now, admittedly, it's a statement from the preceding afternoon, so it's not as immediate as we'd certainly like it to be, but that's the best the judge could do. I mean, he's affording defense counsel the opportunity to voir dire, to make a record.
The argument is that what the judge did was not enough, because in these circumstances, the misimpression that had been created by the incorrect testimony given by the detective the day before was now imprinted on the minds of the jurors and simply couldn't be wiped away with the instruction.
Well, our jurisprudence is that a curative instruction is normally sufficient here, and I think when you strike the testimony, tell the jury to disregard it, and give an appropriate curative instruction, that's sufficient. We assume that jurors follow the instructions of the court. If we weren't making that assumption, we wouldn't be so concerned about all the problems we have with deficiencies in jury instructions at the end of the case. So I think that has to be the assumption, that the jury is in good faith going to follow the instructions of the trial judge, is going to disregard this admittedly confusing and probably incorrect statement or statements here, and then it's the slate's wiped clean, and the trial proceeds from there. And I think that's what the trial judge did, and that was appropriate in this case. The final argument about the inconsistencies in the verdicts here, really given, I guess, three alternative arguments here. One is simply based on this court's decision in Ferguson that while at times you can have a robbery that's not for pecuniary gain, it's not always the case here. And the important language in Ferguson, that where it talks about the distinctions between robbery and pecuniary gain, it says that a robbery as an aggravating factor, focuses on the means of accomplishing the crime, that is, the use of force, whereas pecuniary gain is the aggravating factor, focuses on the motive of the crime, which can be either gain or simply to deprive the owner of the use of the property. Here it was strictly pecuniary gain, however. The second thing I think that might explain some of the confusion here is the unique facts in this particular case, and we're dealing with a lay jury here that the only property that was obtained by the defendant was the property of Turquoise Williams, not the decedent, Donald Jordan, who was the one who was shot. So I think if the jury is looking at this and saying, well, there's a robbery, but you have to have pecuniary gain, well, the only pecuniary gain Mr. Garvey got was taking Turquoise Williams' property. He didn't take any property of Donald Jordan, although he's the one who ultimately was shot. It appears that Mr. Garvey, according to Mr. Williams' testimony, aimed the gun at him, fired a shot, didn't hit Mr. Williams, but apparently unbeknown to the people at the time, it did strike Mr. Jordan, and he ran away and died at a different location in the apartment complex. And finally, I think the last reason to sustain this is that simply this may be another example of jury leniency here, where we recognize that, yes, in a technical, logical sense, the jurors' verdicts don't make sense. It's hard to jive one with the other, but remember the context again, that the finding of guilt was during the guilt phase, this 8-4 inconsistency about whether or not there was pecuniary gain. Eight said there was sufficient evidence to establish the aggravating factor of pecuniary gain, but four did not, whereas the other finding was unanimous during the guilt phase. That at that point, we're in the penalty phase, the jury has to make a decision about whether or not this individual is going to be subject to the death penalty. And that's really the main focus of their determinations here. They later vote 9-3 to recommend life, so certainly there's unease among the majority of the jurors about imposing the death penalty. They've already been instructed by the court that one of the statutory aggravators exists by virtue of the guilty verdict on the robbery, and now they're deciding whether or not a second statutory aggravator exists in this case, and it may simply be another example of the jury not wanting to make Mr. Garvey doubly eligible for the death penalty in this case. That may be one reason why some leniency was accorded here in the verdict. If there's any additional questions, I'll attempt to answer those. Thank you very much.
Very briefly, I think it is a somewhat of a stretch to think that Detective Brock would have thought that the question asked by defense counsel was referring to something other than the tape that had just been seen, something that had been redacted. Detective Brock had laid a foundation, and the state had played tapes for each of the co-defendants. He had heard the instruction from the court to the jury about how they're not to consider anything that may have been redacted, and Detective Brock, being an experienced chief investigating officer, would have known better. With respect to the argument that has just been made with respect to the pecuniary gain and felony murder, to on the one hand say that the jury may have been confused because Donald Jordan was the one that was killed and none of his property was taken is to overlook the arguments that were made by the state in closing in support of the felony murder conviction, which was to make sure to tell the jury that even if no property was taken from Mr. Jordan, that a murder committed in furtherance of the robbery of Turquoise Williams or in furtherance of an attempted robbery of Mr. Jordan would be sufficient. And the instructions with respect to felony murder certainly spelled those out as well. With respect to the lenity or leniency argument, that is just, quite frankly, speculation. I don't think that there is anything to support that. It was 9-3 in favor of life. Whether that represented unease about applying the death penalty or whether or not that was nine people voting one way and three voting another based upon their assessment of the evidence and the law, and the fact that there were four that were unable to find pecuniary gain, I don't see the relationship between those. But if the court has any further questions for me, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear me, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the court.